You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, experts say the recent murder of a mob boss in Staten Island is a reminder that the mafia is alive and well. We'll get a history lesson on the mob and find out what they're up to today. First, it's our weekly look at the big news in state politics. The candidates for a seat on Wisconsin's Supreme Court are making their final pitch to voters, with the election just days away. And two lawsuits challenging laws passed during a lame duck session of the legislature are working their way through the courts. J.R. Ross is the editor of WIS Politics. He talked to Central Time executive producer Judith Sears Poisson earlier today.
So next Tuesday, we'll find out who will replace Shirley Abrahamson on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Lisa Neubauer and Brian Hagedorn met for their final debate earlier this week. What did we hear from them?
We heard both of them question if the other has a temperament and a judgment to be in the Supreme Court, but in different ways. You know, Brian Hagedorn has faced criticism over these kind of old blog posts he wrote while he was a law student about various issues. He said those are an attack on his Christian faith, and that Lisa Neubauer is making these of lying, in his words, about his record in a desperate attempt to get in the court. Neubauer has said she's not lying about anything. She's presenting the facts of what he's written before and question if somebody who would go on the attack against Shirley Abrahamson, who's a retiring justice they're trying to replace, who would write that Senator O'Connor's decisions were, quote-unquote, laughable, has a temperament to be in the Supreme Court. I mean, it's really the last minute, like, give and take, the punches they're throwing each other, trying to leave a final impression with voters ahead of the election. Now, the thing about debates is this. Really, they don't have a huge impact on voters a lot of times because they're not watching them. What people like myself are watching for is there a moment, a slip up, a gaffe that is so dramatic that ends up in a TV ad, a radio ad, and the fact was there probably wasn't. We're not seeing closing arguments based off of the debates. We're seeing the ads that, you know, are accusing Neubauer of being somehow compromised ethically and Hagedorn being somebody who's prescribes to an extreme point of view when it comes to various issues.
Now, these are nonpartisan seats on the Supreme Court, but of course, especially in the last several elections that we've had to fill seats, they have clearly been a battle between someone who's identified as liberal, someone who's identified as conservative. The last time we had a Supreme Court election here, liberal-backed Judge Rebecca Dallet won comfortably. What were the keys to her success?
It was a much different environment, much different opponent than what we're seeing right now. And why I say that is that we were in 2018, we were seeing the blue wave building in Wisconsin, right? And Rebecca Dallet talked openly about her values and about things that really appealed to Democratic voters who were unhappy with President Trump. It was just that was the environment that we were in. This race is much different because it's not quite the same environment. Also, Lisa Neubauer is a different kind of candidate. She's running a very traditional Supreme Court race, one that I saw like 10, 12 years ago, where the candidates really would talk about their endorsements, their experience, and shy away from issues. She has, you know, tried her best not to even talk about what her, or give cues about her just her philosophy is. Now, Brian Hagedorn says that the cues are there, that, you know, she is somebody who looks up to Shirley Abrahamson, who is, again, retiring justice, a longtime liberal in the court, and that the cues are there, whereas, you know, Hagedorn is being open about his conservative philosophy. And it's going to be interesting to watch how this plays out because, one, Hagedorn's old blog post, his association with this Christian school that bans employees who are in gay relationships, they've been used to kind of beat up on him. You know, so how is that going to play? Because a lot of like mainstream Republican groups shied away from him. But the grassroots of the Republican Party may be excited by somebody who's not apologizing for his faith, who's embracing these things. Might that get them energized? And, oh, by the way, we have an environment right now where we just had, you know, Governor Evers produced his budget, which angered Republicans. We had a couple of decisions from Dane County judges about these Republican-passed laws and lame duck sessions. Might these things, oh, even the Mueller report, might these things kind of like help energize a conservative base that had been dispirited after losing in November? Well, I don't know yet. We'll find out on Tuesday. But what I'm trying to get at is it's just a much different environment and different candidates than last time. And it might be the same result. It might not. It's fascinating to watch, especially with the late money we're seeing in this race. What does that mean?
In other Supreme Court news, conservative Justice Dan Kelly, whose seat is up for election next year, 2020, isn't certain that he's going to run. But what are we hearing from him?
Well, you know, he gave one interview in which the impression was that he wasn't sure. But when I talked to him, he sounded much more confident about it. He basically said that he didn't want to make an announcement now because he wanted the focus to be on the current Supreme Court race, but that he told me, kind of paraphrasing here, he couldn't imagine doing anything else or want to do anything else besides be a Supreme Court justice. So he sounded much more likely to announce once this race is over. Now, what's interesting to watch with Kelly is that what happens Tuesday is going to have a big, big impact on how his race shapes up next year. The reason I say that is right now, conservatives have a 4-3 majority on the court. If Lisa Neubauer holds the Abramson seat, that keeps that same 4-3 majority, that means 2020 is for control of the court. That's a big deal. Conservatives have had the majority now for more than a decade. However, it's also a very difficult environment next year for Daniel Kelly if he runs because the presidential primary will be on the ballot the same time as the Supreme Court race. Now, that is an eternity away in politics. But we kind of assume right now the Democrats will have still have a contested primary going on for their nomination come April. We don't think Republicans will have the same kind of deal. If that's going on, that means there'll be many more Democrats voting in April 2020 than Republicans. So for a lot of left-to-center candidates are going, hey, if they can just get to that primary next February and have Kelly one-on-one with that dynamic, they should be in good shape. Now, again, that is an eternity in politics. We have to see how a number of things play out, but it does look like a difficult environment for Kelly next year, regardless of what happens, you know, this coming Tuesday.
We're talking with J.R. Ross. He's the editor of WISP Politics, taking a look at some of the biggest state news stories of the week. And J.R., I don't want to rehash all of the lawsuits and decisions and appeals that have happened with lame duck legislation. We've covered that a lot this week on Central Time. But earlier this week, as a result of one of those decisions, Governor Evers rescinded 82 appointments made by Governor Walker that were approved in the lame duck session. Now he's reappointing 67 of those, but 15 he's choosing not to. What are the most interesting ones out of those 15 who are not getting their jobs?
A couple of the most high-profile ones, Public Service Commission member Ellen Novak, who was Governor Walker's DOA secretary. He moved her over from that job to the PSC in the final days of his administration. She was one of the ones who was not reappointed. Also, there were two members of the UV Board of Regents. Now, what's interesting about this whole thing is, one, Republican lawmakers are arguing that Evers was not in the right to rescind those appointments in the first place. So I'm not a lawyer. I don't play one on TV or the radio, but I will tell you that there's probably going to be some more legal wrangling about these appointments before it's all said and done, because Republicans contend that Evers should not have rescinded those appointments and that this stay from the 3rd District Court of Appeals or that Dane County ruling last week basically says those appointments should be restored. Now, I don't know how it's going to play out, but Novak actually went to work this week after that stay came down, tried to go to her office. She was stopped. So that's going to be fascinating to watch how that plays out. And, oh, by the way, how is the politics playing out for Governor Evers? You know, Governor Evers is somebody who ran last fall talking about reaching across the aisle, trying to be bipartisan, getting things done after 8 years, in his words, of a partisan governor in Scott Walker. But Republicans have complained repeatedly so far that Evers is not living up to his campaign pledge and not reaching across the aisle. Now, you know, in reappointing the 67, maybe that's, you know, an attempt at bipartisan, like, hey, those appointments weren't valid, but hey, I pointed to all these people that Governor Walker wanted. But these other ones, the question is, what will the political price be, if any, for Governor Evers? It's not helping him build a relationship with Republicans, and that bleeds into his budget, because if they can't get along or find some kind of compromise, common ground, how do they reach a deal on that budget, which is the biggest document we're going to see this year?
Well, J.R., we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for bringing us up to speed.
Anytime. Take care.
J.R. Ross is the editor of WISP Politics. He talked to Judith Sears-Poisson with the latest from the state capitol. the death of Frank Cali earlier this month marked the first time a mob boss was killed in New York City in more than 30 years. Cali, the head of the Gambino crime family, was shot several times in front of his Staten Island home. Investigators began looking into possible mob ties, but after arresting an alleged suspect, they said they didn't think the killing was actually mob-related. Experts say mafia activity still very much exists in New York City and probably always will. David Shapiro is a distinguished lecturer at the City University of New York's John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He's also a former FBI special agent who specializes in financial investigations and law enforcement. He talked to Central Time executive producer Judith Sears Poisson.
Pointed out that killings of mob bosses are really pretty rare now and that they don't happen in front of their homes in general. Is that part of the reason why police don't think this particular case was mob related?
Oh, that certainly goes into the decision making. You know, one has to look at the context and the history of people dealing with mobsters or alleged mobsters, as the case may be.
And who was Frank Cali?
Well, depending on what source you believe, he's been referred to as the boss or underboss of the Gambino crime family in the New York City metropolitan area. And that's only recently, too. It's just been for a few years. He's originally from Sicily, and he's been described as old school.
And what does old school mean in mob terms?
An individual who conforms to the expectations and demands of the traditional mafia, that is, the original five families as depicted in the media and by law enforcement. It's a mythology, in a sense, that was captured by the movies Godfather and Goodfellas and so forth, and to a great extent exposed by prosecutors in New York City during the late 80s and early 90s.
You said that Frank Cali rose relatively recently to high leadership, high control in the Gambino family. What was the power vacuum that he kind of stepped into?
Well, the Gottis had run that family for a long time, and they've been in and out of prison for most of the recent 20 years. So while someone can control a small family while inside, the control is less so as time goes on. The loyalty becomes a little bit shredded, and the contacts that one would need in order to perpetuate an effective organized crime family would dissipate over time the longer one spends behind bars.
So, as you said, the Gambino crime family is one of the five families in New York City. Where would you say that they rank as far as power and notoriety is concerned?
Well, they would be near the forefront in terms of recent past. But remember, they got caught up by the United States Attorney's Office in New York City, and to a great extent, their sources of income were jeopardized. They made a lot of money in the garment and hauling industries and trucking waste and so forth, the proverbial waste management. So that was greatly debilitated in the early 90s by, among others, Prosecutor Giuliani.
So having grown up in Chicago, I certainly was aware of the history and contemporary activities of the mob there. But New York really does seem to have kind of a special place in mob activity in the United States. Why New York?
It's where the money is. Remember, the mob, whether we interpret it as old school or traditional, that is five families, or the emergent transnational organized crime, is still based really on where is the money, on getting financial resources. It's just another way of making a buck, although illicitly.
So what was New York City like when mob activity was really at its peak?
It was growing rapidly. It had a strong industrial base, like Chicago and other major cities. And that created opportunities, especially for labor racketeering. The unions, the construction unions, were very strong in New York City. And as a result, when the mob infiltrated these unions, they could put themselves in the middle and do anything from skimming pension and welfare funds to extracting no-show jobs to feather bedding to just running a site outright and controlling labor peace and so forth. So they had a great deal of influence by becoming an intermediary between the construction industry doing the work and the laborers getting the work done.
So the five families have declined in power and reach in recent years. What led to that decline?
Well, I think we have to assess it in two respects. One, we should look at whether their power was what it was represented to be in the first place. Remember, there's a great deal of mythology that goes on in creating these mobsters and a great deal of career development on the part of public prosecutors and criminal investigators because they want to be perceived as catching the big one. So to a great extent, these so-called traditional families may have been blown up to a size that was greater than their actual operations. But that said, what happened over time was very aggressive prosecution at the federal level, and you had the use of sophisticated technology, surveillance, if you will, that had a terrific evidence gathering and kind of put the kibosh on a lot of supporting activities that the mob would usually rely on.
We're talking with David Shapiro right now. He's a distinguished lecturer at the City University of New York's John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He's also a former FBI special agent who specializes in financial investigations and law enforcement. And we're talking about the presence and power of the mafia today. And David, I want to go back to something that you just mentioned. You mentioned the mythology of the mafia. And I think when we think of the mob, we tend to think of pretty violent stuff, like stuffing someone in a trunk of a car or throwing a body in a river, racketeering, pinstripe suits, big Italian meals in a dark room. Is that really what it was like, or was that more of a pop culture fabrication?
I think to a great extent it was a pop culture fabrication because violence and threats of violence are punk, low-class, no-barrier-to-entry activities. That is, any thug can become an extortionist. Any thug can threaten violence. So to a certain extent, we had pictures of these dapper mobsters that were leaders of the crime families, if you will, hobnobbing with politicians and going to fancy restaurants. But the people actually doing the threats, the people actually making things happen, were nowhere near as glamorous as those depicted on screen at fancy restaurants.
So the Italian-American mob was very prominent in places like New York, New Jersey, Chicago. Other than Italian-American mobsters today, are there other groups that have risen in power and influence?
I suggest that we view organized crime as a network of loosely confederated groups across the world. China, Mexico, Colombia, Afghanistan. Think of organized crime, which is not exactly an activity that's revolutionary or highly innovative. Organized crime tends to mirror the economic constructs or the economic structure in place at that time. So while we had a lot of command and control organizations, that is the traditional organized crime families in the 60s and 70s, now we have the gig economy. We have mobsters, organized crime figures, gang figures making deals across the world. In brief, what we're seeing is these gangs and organized crime groups are bringing in drugs to the United States, getting lots and lots of cash, using financial institutions to launder part of it, and selling firearms. So we have our imports or drugs, our exports, our firearms. Oversimplified, of course, because we can add a whole lot of other illicit services and products there, too. But that's in a nutshell. That's in the big picture in the U.S.
You talked about how technology and especially the Internet and digital surveillance has been a boon to law enforcement in confronting the mob. Has that also helped organized crime to make those connections globally?
Undoubtedly, yes. It becomes it becomes a matter of seconds to communicate with a Confederate in Afghanistan or Western Europe or Asia. It's easy, right? Identity theft is easy. Forgery of documentation is easy. Moving money across the world in seconds is easy. So, yes, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away with technology.
And as we wrap up, David, there's that image, as we said, of the heads of these mob families and the loyalty and the structure of the mafia. Are we at a point in history that image is going away? And as you said, it's going to be this very different type of organized crime.
Well, I don't know whether the image is going away, because those powerful narratives may take a long time to dissipate. However, the reality is different. So to the extent that people want to understand truth and reality, they'll have to recognize that command and control structure that existed in the 60s no longer applies. And now we have lots and lots of cells, some known, some unknown, of much smaller size, way more fluid across the world.
Well, David, thanks so much for spending time with us.
Judith, you're welcome.
David Shapiro is a distinguished lecturer at the City University of New York's John Jay College of Criminal Justice. He's a former FBI special agent who specialized in financial investigations and law enforcement. He talked to Judith Sears-Poisson about the recent murder of Gambino family mob boss Frank Cali and the state of the mafia today. At a hearing in the U.S. Senate this week, there was a rare showing of bipartisan agreement on an issue that tends to be one of the most divisive, gun control. Lawmakers were talking about something called red flag gun laws, a way of letting law enforcement or family members ask a court to take away a person's firearms if they're seen as a likely threat to themselves or others. In his opening remarks, Republican Senator Lindsey Graham acknowledged some of the concerns conservatives might have.
There are a lot of people may be worried, is the government going to come take your guns? And the answer is no. Nobody's going to come and take a gun from you, but there will be a process for law enforcement and family members to petition a court to say that somebody in your neighborhood or somebody down the street across town is about to blow.
Robert Spitzer is a distinguished service professor and department chair for political science at the State University of New York, Cortland. His books include Guns Across America, Reconciling Gun Rules and Rights. Robert, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be with you.
Well, can you walk us through in a little more detail how these red flag gun laws work?
Sure. The version in the United States Senate that's being debated, and you just played the clip from Senator Graham, is similar to what we find in the states that have these laws. And by the way, there are 14 states plus the District of Columbia that have a red flag type law in place. The idea is that if there is an imminent threat, and there's an emphasis on a very sort of dire and immediate nature to a threat posed by a person, and this could be a threat to hurt themselves or a threat to hurt others, a kind of a crisis moment, that a person, a family member, for example, or the police directly can go before a judge and ask for a temporary order to have guns withdrawn from that home, from that person, on a temporary basis, subject to a court hearing that's held shortly thereafter to determine what's going on. Does this person, in fact, pose such a threat or not? And if so, the guns can be kept away permanently. If not, the guns can be returned to the person. And this sounds like something that, you know, might be happening prolifically, but in the 14 states that have had these laws in place, and a number of these states have enacted these laws fairly recently, there's only been a little over 1,000 cases that have occurred up until now. So it's a pretty small number, but it does provide a safety valve moment for somebody who clearly is having emotional problems, is having, you know, anger issues that are evident to the people around them, and it's a way that guns can be pulled out of that situation, at least temporarily.
How are states defining that threshold? Because it seems like there could be a lot of gray area in trying to determine what might pose an imminent threat.
That's true, and you'd really have to burrow into the particular laws of the particular states. I'm sure there are variations in wording, but the general emphasis in these laws is on an immediate, imminent threat. You know, somebody saying, I'm going to kill myself, for example. And by the way, the biggest threat tends to be, when connected to guns, tends to be suicide, not homicide. There certainly are gun homicides and threats made with guns every year, but nationwide, pretty consistently, there are about twice as many gun suicides as there are gun homicides. And that is very much a concern because of the fact that a gun is a very effective way for a person to kill oneself, more effective than any other method.
I know these are all, I think, fairly new. Do we have any kind of indication as to whether red flag gun laws are having an impact when it comes to suicide numbers or homicide numbers in these states?
Well, given the relatively small numbers, there aren't what you would call decisive statistics. However, it is the case that in at least two states, in Indiana and in Connecticut, both states have had these laws on the books for a while. Indiana saw an almost 8% reduction in the firearm suicide rate after it enacted one of these laws, and Connecticut saw a 14% reduction in the firearm suicide rate after it enacted its similar red flag law. So there is good evidence to see, in particular with respect to suicide, that this can have an effect. And we also know that there's a sort of a different but related body of research regarding the intersection of domestic violence, threats within the context of an intimate relationship, a husband, a wife, an intimate partner, where threats and violence can escalate, and where, when guns are present in such a situation, the likelihood that a fatality will result escalates significantly. So there's pretty good reason to believe that this is a place and a time and a moment where you really want the government to have some ability, with procedural safeguards, to intervene.
Talking to Robert Spitzer, political science professor at the State University of New York, Cortland, about red flag gun laws. Let's take this to Congress now, Robert. As I understand it, what they're talking about there in the Senate is not creating a federal red flag gun law, but rather creating ways for states to help states do their own laws.
I don't have a lot of the details on the federal effort, but the very fact that the Republican-controlled Senate and Senator Graham, who's pretty conservative and considered pretty strongly gun rights, is saying this is a worthy idea, we should investigate this and encourage movement along these lines, I think is fairly significant. And it's also important to note that a number of the states that have enacted these laws are states where they were signed into law by Republican governors. So it is one measure that has found genuine bipartisan support.
How does the NRA, the National Rifle Association, fit into the politics surrounding red flag gun laws?
Well, they're trying to walk a fine line on this issue. They say they support the idea in principle, but they're not too happy with the existing measures that are floating around. These are measures that are popular, that law enforcement wants to have as a tool, obviously that threatened relatives would be able to utilize. So they're not flat out against it, but they're kind of casting aspersions on existing laws and the measure at the federal level, as if to say that, well, if they could get the law right, maybe the NRA would be okay with it, but they're not sure that that's happened yet.
One concern I've seen is due process rights, violations of due process rights for someone who's had their gun taken away. They don't have, before the gun is initially taken away, the ability to challenge this in the courts. Usually they can do that retroactively after the fact. Is this a common objection to these kind of laws?
It is. It certainly is. I mean, any notion of taking away somebody's guns for any reason always raises some suspicion, even under circumstances and some awareness on the part of the gun community. But it is clear that there are some circumstances where that is warranted. And it's typically the case that a judge can issue what's called an emergency order to pull guns from a residence, from, let's say, a person who's made specific threats. and they then schedule a hearing. The hearing has to be held in a fairly short space of time, and that is part of the idea of having some procedural safeguards. And you're, you know, presenting information before a magistrate. It's not only on, well, a person says that somebody else poses a threat, and so the police sweep in, and that's it. They do. There is some evaluation of the claims, consideration of some kind of evidence, and then you do have the formal hearing later on to determine whether, in fact, the gun should be returned to the person or not.
We're talking to Robert Spitzer from the State University of New York, Cortland. He's with us to talk about red flag gun laws that allows law enforcement and sometimes others to ask a court for permission to remove guns from a person's possession if it's agreed they pose a threat to themselves or others, an imminent threat. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the idea of red flag gun laws? Do you think they strike a good balance between public safety and the Second Amendment? Would you want to see some version of this law here in Wisconsin? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about red flag gun laws and how they fit into the wider gun debate. Robert Spitzer is with us from the State University of New York, Cortland. He's written multiple books on gun politics in the United States, among others. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of this idea, allowing police or in some cases family members to petition a court to request that firearms be removed from the possession of a person seen as an imminent threat to others or to themselves? If you're a gun owner, what do you think of this idea? And in general, would you want to see this happen here in Wisconsin? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll go to a caller now. Bob is with us in New Berlin. Bob, hello.
Hi. I support gun rights, but with that being said, I was once, not so long ago, sitting on the edge of a bed in a mental ward with a man I was visiting who was very, very angry that his guns had been taken from him. And he was saying, you know, it makes you wonder how much you can take before you just grab your gun and take out as many people as you can before they take you out. And I think, you know, that was scary. And what's worse is, of course, he did get his guns back. He's, you know, he wasn't convicted of violence or anything, but he was mentally ill and certainly expressing to me that he had the idea that, you know, this would be a good thing. And what I told him, I said, well, because you're a Christian, you can't do that. Otherwise, you have to find a different religion or something, because that's not the way of the Bible. And he looked down and he said, yeah, I guess you're right.
Bob, thanks a lot for sharing that experience with us. Robert, can you talk about how people in that kind of situation in a state with a red flag gun law would then proceed?
Well, yes. And let me thank Bob for calling in and sharing his story, because that's a real life moment of how this kind of thing to play. And note also that this action, these red flag laws, are triggered by some very specific language that is designed to set a pretty high bar at the point at which the local police might intervene. And it also, it's not to say that anybody who has mental illness is going to have their guns taken away. After all, most people who have mental illness issues are not a threat of violent, don't pose a violent threat to themselves or others. Some people do if, for example, you're suicidal or if you're in a homicidal rage and it might be related to your mental condition, then that stuff does come into play. So it's the attitude plus the expression of, you know, I'm going to kill myself or I'm going to kill these people that then could trigger a red flag law action.
Thanks again for calling and sharing that experience. We'll go now to Karen with us in Cambridge. Karen, hello.
Hi. I have a question about what happens now. if my loved one is sitting in the bathroom with a gun threatening to kill himself and I call 911, can they not come and confiscate that weapon now?
Karen, thanks for the law. Robert, I don't know if you know specifically in Wisconsin, but in general, without a red flag gun law, what generally happens?
That's a good question, and it depends on how the existing law in Wisconsin is written. There have been efforts in some places in the past to make it pretty difficult for police to intercede and to eliminate or to pull out weapons from a situation of that nature. So it's hard for me to say, you know, how the existing law reads, but of course part of the purpose of the red flag law is to try to intercede before the point at which a person's holding a gun, pointing it at his or her head, or pointing it at the body of another human being in close proximity and, you know, clearly indicating violence. You'd like to get to that, intercede before that final step occurs.
In our last couple of minutes, Robert, do you see these red flag gun laws likely to spread now to more and more states?
It does seem likely that more and more states will pick up on these, partly because they found bipartisan support in a number of states. And I would add that there is a precedent for these laws, even though these red flag laws themselves are relatively new. If you go back to the 19th, 18th, and even 17th century in America, you saw many laws enacted by states and communities against brandishing. That is the threatening display of a weapon. And that all by itself, under old American laws in the states and even in some of the colonies, was a punishable effect. And this is sort of a modern version of that, where they're trying to get to the point just before a person may actually have a gun, brandish it, and threaten others. So the idea of threatening people with a gun is one that actually has roots in our law, and I think you'll see these modern laws spreading to other states.
And again, briefly, as we wrap up, is this a law, despite all the divisiveness over gun control issues, is this a law that you can see people from both parties working together on?
I think that has already been demonstrated. Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, conservative Republican, is indicating support. The very fact that they held hearings, which the majority party does not have to do, is an indication that they believe in the United States Senate that this is a measure worthy of careful and serious examination. And I think that's a good thing. And I think it's one area where opposing sides on the gun issue and of the political parties can reach across the aisle and do some constructive bipartisan work.
We'll leave it there. Robert, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure. Good to speak with you.
That was Robert Spitzer, Distinguished Service Professor and Department Chair for Political Science at the State University of New York, Cortland. His books include Guns Across America, Reconciling Gun Rules and Rights. He joined us today to talk about red flag gun laws after some Republicans in the U.S. Senate said this week they're open to helping states to pass those kind of gun regulations. On Tuesday, voters will pick Wisconsin's next Supreme Court justice. Appeals Court judges Brian Hagedorn and Lisa Neubauer are both running to replace retiring Justice Shirley Abrahamson. In our second of two stories on the candidates, Sean Johnson has this profile of Neubauer, who has downplayed her ties to the Democratic Party and emphasized her time on the bench.
Almost every candidate tries to stay on message when they run for statewide office. Appeals Court Judge Lisa Neubauer is no exception. At a recent debate with Appeals Court Judge Brian Hagedorn at the Wisconsin State Bar Center in Madison, it wasn't hard to guess which points Neubauer wanted people to remember.
My record shows that I am tough but fair. My record shows that I am fair, impartial, and independent. Justice, be fair, impartial, independent. That I will be fair, impartial, and independent.
And that was just during her opening statement. Neubauer repeated some variation of tough, independent, and fair at least a dozen times during that debate, and she drove home other points, too. For more than a decade, she said, she's been a judge, and she has endorsements from the vast majority of judges throughout Wisconsin.
Over 98% of the judges endorsing this race are supporting me, and they are willing to support me publicly. I have put them on my website.
In this officially nonpartisan election, Neubauer's ties to the Democratic Party run deep. Her daughter, Greta Neubauer, is a Democratic state representative. Her husband, Jeff Neubauer, is a former lawmaker who once ran the state Democratic Party. But compared to recent Supreme Court campaigns, what Neubauer is saying is less partisan. She steers clear of many of the buzzwords candidates often use to hint at their political leanings. She won't even say who she considers her most influential Supreme Court justices.
To the extent people want to understand sort of where I come from, what my philosophy is, I ask that they judge me based on my record.
Neubauer is taking this approach while others are firing up the Democratic base for her. Among those campaigning here is a group led by former U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder called the National Democratic Redistricting Committee.
Bound and determined, I'm back in Wisconsin, you know.
Thank you.
How are
you
all doing? All right.
During a recent visit to Madison, Holder said he did not worry that his support for Neubauer would undercut her nonpartisan message.
You know, it's not as if Republicans aren't doing the same thing, you know? It's not as if, you know, business groups aren't pouring tons of money into these races, you know? And I'm just dealing with the reality of the situation. And so I'm proud to be here, and I'm proud to support, you know, Lisa.
Neubauer says she'll recuse herself from any cases involving Holder. But her opponent, Judge Brian Hagedorn, says there's a reason groups like Holder's are supporting Neubauer.
They want to take over the Supreme Court because they want to politicize it. They want the court to be a part of their political agenda. And they think Judge Neubauer is exactly the person for the job.
Neubauer's backers argue it's not Holder's support that's key in this race. Appeals Court Judge Lisa Stark, who has endorsed Neubauer, says it's more telling that 345 judges have supported Neubauer over Hagedorn, even though they both serve on the same Court of Appeals.
That says a lot. These are the people who either their decisions are reviewed by her on a regular basis or they work with her directly. And they also work with Judge Hagedorn. And they know the two of them. And they have supported Judge Neubauer. So I think that speaks volumes.
Conservatives currently hold a 4-3 majority on the Supreme Court. A Hagedorn victory would expand that margin. A Neubauer win would preserve it and set the stage for a 2020 campaign that could flip the court's ideological balance. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
WPR's profile of Judge Brian Hagedorn aired yesterday. You can read or listen to both of those stories at WPR.org or WisconsinVote.org. And while you're at WisconsinVote.org, you can do more election-related stuff. Election Day is April 2nd. At WisconsinVote.org, you can find your polling place, view your sample ballot, read candidate profiles, and more. Coming up Monday on Central Time, the census is a-coming next year, and it could have a big impact on states and how we're represented in Congress. We'll find out why Wisconsin could lose a congressional seat when the counting is done. You can find out the latest news from Wisconsin Public Radio and ask your questions on this month's edition of Mondays with Mike. And we might think of roller skating as a quaint old-time tradition, and we'd be wrong. We'll find out why roller rinks are back in style, and maybe I'll try on some skates. Spoiler alert, I won't. That and more, it's all coming up Monday here on Central Time.